Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. More like Greatest Discovery.
Yeah, because we're just here to drag it.
No, we're not. That's the thing.
I saw somebody posting a Reddit about just taking wiffle ball practice on this episode, and I was like, both A, that's not the vibe that we are going for here, and B, why this episode of all episodes? I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself.
Yeah, no.
I was just looking at that through a feverish set of peepers, Adam. I was sick as hell this week.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy and surprised to be doing this show with you this morning.
Yeah.
After the week we've had, we've taken an unscheduled week off on production because of your illness.
I was feeling a little bit crappy on Sunday and woke up feeling really bad on Monday. And I was like, oh, this is probably one of those 24-hour things, except for I had a
24-hour hangover.
I mean, it kind of felt like a hangover, to be honest, but I hadn't been drinking. So I was like, what gives? Not fair.
I mean, should I just drink then? If this is how I'm going to feel anyway? What the fuck?
Yeah. Maybe if I drink now, it'll all go in reverse.
Yeah. Yeah. Tenet your alcoholism. I haven't seen Tenet. I'm just using context clues to make that joke happen.
I watched Tenet last weekend. Did not understand a single moment of it. Enjoyed it immensely.
Did you enjoy the joke?
I did.
All right.
I thought the joke works.
Okay, good.
Newsflash, the joke works.
Good. I mean, we're already giving Rob very little time to edit this episode, and I want to make sure all of my jokes land and none of the bad ones get cut out. We're going 100% good jokes on this ep.
I've literally been in bed for over a week, so...
God.
So I'm... We'll see if I even have the stamina to do this episode.
To the extent that I can care about anyone else besides me and my wife and my puppy, I was and am concerned about you, man. I hope you're on the backside of this, the backside being the better side, the booty side of being sick.
I was concerned too, my man, but I have some great news for you. I'm going to hold it up to the camera, Jackie and Laureate.
Coronavirus negative.
That's a pregnant pause, buddy.
Wow, man.
I thought I had it for sure.
In some ways, I'm disappointed by that news because the idea that there's something else out there that can knock down a co-host for an entire week that isn't the big bug.
Yeah.
I mean, are you disappointed?
I am. And I the other thing is I'm just baffled because I've been so careful.
Yeah.
It's literally the first time I've been sick at all in any way this year, which is a blessing. But
right.
I thought that all of the efforts I was taking to protect myself and my family from COVID were going to work for all of the other things too. And something got around the gate.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sucked.
It could have just been a different flu bug.
Yeah, I think it was some influenza that my flu vaccine did not inoculate against.
Gotta tell you, I was expecting a super old Dr. Pulaski face to greet me on the video feed here. You look good and you sound better than I was expecting. So I think we can do a show.
Let's do our best to give the people an episode of The Greatest Discovery. More importantly, to give Rob's an episode of The Greatest Discovery to edit in time to release on time.
Yeah. I mean, look, you may have been the sick one, but Rob is the one that suffers in a situation like this.
Absolutely.
And that's too bad.
Sorry, Rob. Do you want to get into it, Adam?
Yeah, let's go ahead and get this one done for Rob. Let's do it for Rob.
Let's do it.
Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 12. There is a tide. Is the name of it, and it's probably the last Jonathan Frakes directed episode of the season, unless he does the finale, right? Is he doing the finale? Oh, yeah.
I imagine that he wouldn't. I mean, it's kind of rare to do two back-to-back TV episodes like that.
If anyone has the stamina to go back-to-back, it's John W. Frakes.
Yeah, that's a powerful man, Adam.
The Discovery has jumped to within range of Federation HQ, and it's got the Viridian on its tail, but it's just shooting firecrackers at it. That's the idea.
This is like a shot for shot New Hope opening, isn't it?
Mm.
The disco with the Viridian bearing down on it, just like the Hammerhead trying to escape the Star Destroyer. Speaking of Star Destroyers, Adam, we're going to destroy a Lego Star Destroyer.
Oh, yeah.
That's this year's Falcon.
People always love that about us, our willingness to destroy something of value. This scene made me appreciate that quality to the ship in a way maybe I haven't before. By the ship, I mean the Discovery. Like, remember when they first showed the first imagery of the Discovery and it looked all flat and long and people were like,
yeah.
This is one of the other reasons people were like, this is not my Star Trek. Look at how flat and pizza boxy that fucking ship is. But now, like in the future, with the new nacelles and the cool color temperature lights to it, it looks like it belongs more in the future than it did in its contemporary time. Did you feel that way?
Oh, yeah. That's a great call. It also just presents kind of a narrower target, like... I know that the Viridian's pulling this punch, but if somebody was chasing you and shooting at you, you would want to be like a thin,
oh yeah,
kind of hard to hit object.
It doesn't work so well in middle school when you're thin being chased by a more powerful object. Only in space, I guess, does that help you.
Right. Yeah, that's what little middle school Adam would always yell at his bullies. I wish I was in space.
The idea that the bridge crew is in the ready room and the rest of the crew is in the brig is, I think, the main sticking point for this episode. And the reasons that this is that is the way it is versus any other way is the main reason that this episode can work, I think. If that is reversed or done in any other way, I think the story doesn't hang together. It doesn't work functionally.
Yeah. So we get some time with Admiral, the photo that comes in an executive picture frame, working with his crew. And he's a bit suspicious of Disco. Like they don't know whether or not to open the garage door or not. And they, you know, have good reasons to be suspicious, but also kind of have to give the Disco the benefit of the doubt, given the huge warship that is bearing down on it.
It's really cargo bay hypocritical, where like the Disco rolls around in space with its back flap open, you know, perpetually, and and Federation HQ is a closed system. It's got its overalls buttoned all the way up.
The pacing of this is so interesting to me, because it's both breathless, but it also has lots of little moments that let you catch your breath. Like, there's the moment on the bridge where Osira and the other lady are talking about how there's these weird old-timey movies mm-hmm. on the computer, and they're like, what are these?
Yeah.
And it's just like planting the sphere data question in your mind.
Right.
In a subtle way. It's like, I can't believe that these two people are talking about this, but I kind of buy it for some reason.
There's a quality to the takeover that is something we haven't really seen before outside of like a Borg hostile takeover, right? Like, there's this yeah. need for Osira to convert the Disco's operating system to something that the chain uses.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem like a need or an interest that anyone else has ever had in capturing a starship.
We've gotten Die Hard in space on Star Trek before. Uh-huh. This episode, with things like that, kind of did it in a way that I had wished it had been done before, which is like, give us more of that Star Trek-y shit in your Die Hard. It's like 100% up on the Die Hard slider and 100% up on the Star Trek slider. It's not backing off of one or the other to accommodate, you know?
That's true.
Guess we'll find out.
We also run back into Zara, the guy from the ice planet. He's his hand now looks like Mr. Deeds's foot.
Yeah. Look, when you have a disfiguring ice injury and you choose not to get it Luke Skywalker'd out, like in the form of a bionic hand.
Yeah.
It doesn't give me a lot of faith in the Emerald Chain as a like functioning technology body.
Yeah.
Like, it confirms the whole junkyard aesthetic of the chain
right.
being what it is. And that's weird because that conflicts with what we learn about the chain later on and their abilities. Like, they do have a lot of interesting technology abilities to bring to bear, but not enough to fix Jake Weber's hand.
Well, yeah, like maybe there's a planet in the Emerald Chain where you could get this fixed, but it's so far away that it's just, you know, unreachable yeah. or something. Like, or maybe it's an aesthetic choice. He's like, this is cool. This makes me seem even more space piratey, and I like that about it.
There's no way that hand doesn't smell, though, is the thing. Like, yeah. I get the aesthetic, but you got to put on a glove. Here's what you do, Ben. You get yourself a glove made out of the silver thread, the antimicrobial thread. I think we know where to get those, yeah. right?
Not before you let Tilly hit your hand with a fireplace poker just to demonstrate how little feeling it right. has, though.
Yeah, you got to do
the hideousness will haunt my dreams forever.
This is the most Mr. Deedsy episode we've ever done. Huh? This is what you want to do with this episode? Okay, yeah. I'm here for it.
So Book's ship has chased this whole situation through one of the transwarp conduits, and we get to see why transwarp conduit travel is not a fun way to go. It's a real mess in there.
Someone needs to go in there with a cow catcher on the front of their ship and clear that thing out.
That seems like valuable scrap.
Tunnels get flushed, Ben. Why don't we get in there with a great big hose and push the debris through?
Yeah. You know, like, much like a bidet can sometimes get a little water like further up than you think that it might, but that can sometimes free up some things that you didn't know you still had.
We're using a new piece of technology that involves a small fiber optic camera at the end of it and this spool of cable.
Speaking of poop shoots, Book's ship goes right into Disco's.
As
Disco is going through the garage door.
This is a non-consensual shuttle bay entry here.
Yeah, and they crash land inside the ship as the Disco is accepted into Federation HQ with the door slammed behind it. And we go to opening credits.
A little later, we see the little robots, the DAT 23s, go to work on Book ship. Like, is that just automatic? If something breaks on the Discovery, does one of these things just show up and get to work? Because if I'm on the chain team, the chain gang, if you will, and I'm on the Discovery, you don't want Book ship being repaired. Like, you want to capture and control, right?
If Book's ship is being repaired, that's going to make a lot of noise, and that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang.
Osira is naturally pissed about the rear action in the shuttle bay.
Yeah. Not like mirror universe level pissed, right? She's not like killing the person that was incompetent enough to let it happen, but definitely letting them know she's taking great umbrage with this.
We should have seen them coming and blown them out of the sky.
This is a walk and talk as they head down to engineering, where she meets her good time buddy, Invigilator Aurelio, who is one of the great scientists of the Emerald Chain. And this is where we get to see a bit of a softer side of Osira.
I got to say, the Invigilator name is something I'm only familiar with from an adult bookstore or like a sex toy section of a website.
Yeah, it sounds like something Dr. Ruth would bring up.
Yeah, the Invigilator has like a couple of rabbit ears on it and kind of a ring of pearls.
Yeah, she takes it out of her bag of tricks on Conan and the audience goes crazy. And
yeah, I'm glad the chair has advanced past flashing light as a form of communication.
Yeah.
For someone inside. Like, great to see Kenneth Mitchell back on the show, obviously. And he is sort of the conscience of the chain.
Yeah.
At this moment in time. And he really has Osira's ear.
Right. She trusts him. She likes him. She presents a version of herself to him that we haven't met before. And I thought that the scene was really great for establishing that case.
Just to be clear, this is a show that does not tend to do that, though. Like, we have jumped to the relationship they have without any reason for the treatment of a person in this case. Like this guy, Ariello, is treated far better than her own flesh and blood nephew, for sure.
That's true. But also, like, something about the way they interact makes you wonder, like, how much about her he knows, even, you know, and that's something that's exploited later in the episode. I think it's well planted here. So, he's gonna try and figure out like how Stamets is able to do spore jumps in the math of Die Hard. The ship is the C4 and Stamets is the detonators, and Michael Burnham is gonna have to try and get the detonators away from the Gruber gang.
I kept wondering who the smarmy rat fuck turncoat was going to be of the bridge crew, you know?
What am I, method actor Hans?
Like, at least give them something to do. Like, like if Bryce was like, Osira, babe, opens up a can of Coke.
Yeah. The problem is Bryce doesn't have enough facial hair to have cocaine caught in it for jokes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That is the thing about Bryce, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's the main thing that we know about him.
Before Osira leaves Aurelio, she like flicks on the hi-fi unit before leaving.
Yeah.
And starts blasting that good opera into the room. It's a good thing she knows Kenneth Mitchell's character likes it.
Yeah.
And when the crown of Borg is removed from Stamets, he's into it too.
Yeah. He loves opera. We know this about him.
I guess. In the shuttle bay, Book gives Michael Burnham a reason to say I love you by giving her the ring that she's always desired, the ring that makes her anonymized by the ship's sensors.
Yeah. Will you put this on and make me the most not sure where you are on the ship man that's ever lived?
It's one of those pieces of jewelry that you can give without the bad feelings of giving, like, this isn't a blood bracelet, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. There's no movie about Leonardo DiCaprio and Jaimon Hansu in a test of wills.
I would have bet you almost every penny I've got that at some point there would be a scene where Zara thinks they found Michael Burnham and instead it's the bracelet around a cat.
or a fucking bundle of bombs, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Ho, ho, ho. Now I've got a dot 23.
That would have been great.
Yeah. But they can't do that. And you know why, right? Like you can suggest a knowledge of and enjoyment of the Die Hard, but you can't actually have Michael Burnham walk on broken glass, right? You can't actually ho, ho, ho a dot 23.
Right. I mean, what would even broken glass be on this ship? It's probably all broken transparent aluminum. Future.
You wouldn't even know you're walking over it. It would still be transparent. What a problem it would be.
Yeah.
All vessels, weapons hot.
So the Admiral kind of figures out that that Disco is not quite what it presented itself to be, and has all the ships in space dock like heat their weapons up. One of them, I think it's the USS Song, gets like 10 feet away from the Disco, and I'm like, that is not where you want to be if you're about to start shooting at a spaceship. We've seen what happens when they blow up.
We're getting more and more of a look at the other ships gathered in this area. And one of them to me just looks like a funnel. Just a fucking funnel. A funnel ship.
This seems like a handy ship to have in the kitchen, but a little bit hard to find storage for.
I know.
It's like never quite fits in a drawer, but it seems annoying to put in a cabinet.
You pull out the drawer and it always catches.
Yeah.
Ugh. You gotta like reach under and no thanks. I'd rather go without.
Yeah, the worst.
Good job, Admiral Uncle your dad never talks about because they don't see eye to eye politically. Like, he's connected the dots here. And, like, not a moment too soon, right?
Right.
Who knows what Discovery would have done? And I wish I did, right? Like, you get the sense that this was the plan the whole time, was to become captured in order to put Osira in the same room as the Admiral.
Yeah.
But what if?
What if they just eliminated Disco, yeah.
Or what if the Disco goes in weapons hot and starts kicking ass inside before the Admiral puts it together?
It's an interesting plan Osira has. I think that this is about when she like hollows over there to talk to him. And she introduces herself as Minister Osira. And this is another side of Osira that I just don't feel like I understood. Like, I thought of her as space gangster, warlord, you know, bad guy, but she has like a political title within the Emerald Chain, and she is there to talk turkey. She's taking hostages. She's controlling the most valuable ship in his fleet, but also is like trying to make a political overture to him.
Right. All of the damage done by every one of her moves up to this point still makes sense if her end goal was to be sitting across from a conference table from the Admiral, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this didn't come out of left field for me that all of this crazy would be behind us and there is a measured, thoughtful Osira at the end here when it comes time to be that person.
Right, because it's just good math, right? Like, she is not so crazy that she thinks that the way to solve her dilithium problem is to start a war with somebody who also has no dilithium, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
I thought this was an interesting and smart development in the script. Michael Burnham gets her first body on the Disco. Book has been taken into the mess hall with the rest of the bridge crew, and Michael Burnham is like choking a guy out in some kind of like judo leg hold. He gets a knife into her leg, and we get the cauterizing the wound scene, but it's Star Trek that I have always wanted, which is a Star Trek character gets stabbed, but still gets like a lot of the mission done because it's actually not that big a deal to get stabbed when you can wave a light over it.
I mean, it's not just a light. She uses a phaser to cauterize it.
Yeah.
And the reason she has to do that is because it feels like this is a ship and a way of being where there should be a med kit around every corner, the way that you could find a fire extinguisher in an office building every 60 feet or whatever. Like,
right.
And crucially, they're right next to a place where you put on a suit to go out into space. Like, if there's ever a spot for all of your med kit needs, they should be right there, right?
I guess so. I didn't realize that that was a phaser. I thought that she was using some kind of medical device.
I mean, one of us might be wrong here. Fairly confident I know who that is.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm looking back at the image of it now,
oh, yeah.
And it is a phaser. But
yeah.
What my theory presupposes is the badge is a tricorder and a communications device and a transporter. Can the phaser also be some kind of medical device?
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. That's a great call.
It doesn't look fun what she's going through, right? Like, it doesn't look like using the phaser to heal the wound is ideal. Like, it doesn't look like the way you would want to do it if you had a Culber around to actually help you.
The scene starts with an inciting incident of that asshole like trying to scrape a dead person's comm badge off of their memorial wall.
Yeah.
I mean, that underscores his necessity to die, right? Like, we're not going to feel bad for him because he's a bad person. Is that the idea?
He's a grave robber.
Yeah. Those badges are really on there, Ben.
Yeah. They used a two-step epoxy to get them on there because we want those badges to stay up for time immemorial.
There's a little wordplay for your enjoyment.
This scene ends with Michael Burnham in the Jeffries tube sending out a mayday call to her mom that sort of says everything, but I guess our cause is starting to look a little lost. You could tell a Coat Malat would be very useful in a starship takeover scenario like this.
Mom, the hijacking does not go well for Discovery. Far worse than is generally known. If you're going to Mayday, what other option does she have for someone to call for help? I was really racking my brain about this. At first, I was like, "Oh, that's convenient. We're gonna get Mom back on the scene." For some reason. And then I really thought about it and I'm like, everyone's here.
Sides do not stay on the sidelines.
I mean, like, Navarre presumably has at least one ship that's still capable of warp, right? Like, there's no way Michael Burnham's mom is not showing up next episode, is what I'm trying to say.
Right, but I mean, was the Discovery the only ship capable of going out there and coming back in an amount of time that makes sense?
Who knows, man?
We aren't permitted to know those pesky details. Lots of I love yous on this episode.
Yeah.
Ben?
Yeah. A lot of love in this room.
Remember when the Jeffries tube had floor grates?
This seems like a much easier on the knees version of the Jeffries tube.
They look to me like those flat, by flat, I mean flat versus gloss, like flat weight room tiles, you know, that are made out of sort of a corky material.
Right.
Way more comfortable on the knees if you're crawling around in there. Very absorbent of the leaky leg wound.
Yeah, if you're going to be fixing an EPS conduit or doing a CrossFit exercise, this is the kind of flooring you want.
So Osira has beamed over to Federation HQ to meet Admiral School Principal, who's not mad, he's just disappointed. And they set up the terms for this visit, and they agree to these terms immediately, Ben. Those terms are don't start nothing, won't be nothing.
Yeah, don't come for me unless I've sent for you, basically.
This location's a place of trust, too, right? Like, you're standing on this balcony. The fall looks like 3 or 4 stories to the bottom.
Yeah.
There's no guardrails.
Although, like, a piece of floor could materialize under you at any point in that fall, yeah. You know?
That's true. It's trust flooring.
Yeah.
Is what it is. It was developed at a manager's conference many centuries ago.
This is a flooring that's very hot among management types. She asks why, given what they're here to talk about, she can't meet with the president of the Federation. And he explains, well, we haven't cast that person yet, so you're going to have to meet with me. And they sit down and start talking about basically like a merger of the Federation and the Emerald Chain. Like, why not combine our resources? You've got a spore drive. We've got brilliant scientists. We could be a big organization that deals with lots of people. And Like maybe there's something we could do here to both solve our dilithium problem and end hostilities between our peoples.
Are you clear enough on what the Federation lacks in order to make this negotiation make some sense? Because like in the logic of the show, I think the show is very confident in this being an intriguing possibility and there being some fairness to a negotiation where both sides get some things that they need and sacrifice some things that they need to sacrifice. Like,
right.
I don't feel like we know enough about the Federation to be like, come on, man. Like this is good for you. I feel like the chain is still so bad at this point that I wasn't sure how to feel.
My feeling is that they are relying on Navarre not being a part of the Federation anymore to sell that Osira's science people are a tempting enough offer here. But I agree with you that it's strange credulity at the beginning. And I loved how this whole thing went because of how the Admiral flips it on its ear toward the end. But this opening overture, I was really worried about what the show was going to ask me to buy in terms of like what he was willing to accept in a diplomatic scenario. Cause yeah, we just don't know.
It's part of the muddiness of this relationship where like there are still hostages right outside the window that the Admiral knows about that right. She has control of, and they are a very little part of this conversation that they have in this room.
Yeah. That, I mean, like they talk about like the not important parts of the crew being loaded onto shuttlecraft and then they are like off to the races. Let's call it the United Federation of Chains.
Yeah.
Which is Two Chains' sixth studio album, actually.
Nice. I mean, Osira even does that bit of wordplay. Like she transposes the Federation and the chain terminology right. to describe their different sides to things.
It's tantalizing. And like the thing that I wondered if was being set up here is this when the Admiral makes his heel turn and reveals himself to be a bad because he is willing to kind of sacrifice Federation principles in order to get some kind of political stability, but at what cost? Yada yada yada.
It's a great question to ask at this point, especially because Osira is so much more likable in that room.
Yeah, a great sequence of scenes. Back on Discovery in the mess hall, the bridge crew have Star Trek fought all of the motorcycle bad guys that have them hostage. One thing I wanted to talk about here was that, like, they talk about the computers being taken over again in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
And as a viewer, we are conscious of the Sphere Data at this moment, but it's just kind of left to us to wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would have been really interesting to see the crew process the idea that the Sphere Data has been deleted and what a tragedy that would seem like to them.
This crew was willing to sacrifice everything to keep it safe from control. And now that their ship has been taken over by a force that could be malevolent, like it's not control bad, but it's still like the bad guys. Where is the urgency having to do with the Sphere Data? There really isn't any.
I mean, like, it seems like they accept the idea that it's just gone. But I wanted, like, even somebody saying, like, God, like, the Sphere Data, like we gave so much to protect it, and it's sad that it's gone, but at least it's not, you know, like, Osira was too stupid to know what she had, so at least...
That's a really nice, like, salt with the sweet. Like, there's so much about this episode is fun in that diehard kind of way, but incorporating a little bit of grief... there might have been a nice counterbalance, like emotionally, for the thing.
Totally.
The grief we get is actually presented to us by Stamets, right? And it begins in this scene with Aurelio, where Stamets is doing that thing that a hostage can work in their favor, which is by making themselves a real person in the eyes of someone with that kind of grip on them,
yeah,
so as to save their own lives. And so he's trying to bond with Aurelio over the idea that they both have children, even though Stamets's child is unconsensually in that relationship with him.
But also, like, Aurelio doesn't know that. Like, this is one of the first episodes this season where I really liked Stamets as a character. Like, I felt like this is Stamets, like, but it took him being unjustly imprisoned to, like, get his mojo back.
Here's the thing, like, I could totally read this as a guy saying something to bond with someone to save their life, but I also can't rule out that this is a series and episode of television where they would just write that Stamets has assumed custodial or parental control over Adira, and that's just how it is,
right?
And we skipped that part, and he's the father and Adira is their child, and like that's what it is. It's a quality that you have described before, is like, we're not writing our way to a destination, we're just announcing that we've arrived.
Yeah. And again, like, if in episode 3 or 4 or whatever it was where we met Adira, Stamets had been like, hey, she can stay with us, that would have been,
yeah,
that would have, like, then, like, all we needed to get to this line. But
that's something that's so frustrating about this show at times, is like, you could see the fix in a half a line of dialogue.
Yeah. I wonder if that's the kind of thing that in season 1 or 2 they could fix by just going back and getting a quick insert, and they couldn't this season.
That's a great defense of this, and I'm totally willing to buy that.
I mean, who knows, right? Like, the way television is produced is really different from the way films are produced, but when you shoot a film and you then, like, screen it for a test audience and see where it's working and where it's not, you can go back and get pickups and cut scenes and change the order of stuff to, like, to really nail it. And I feel like the post-production on this one, and especially, like, because I think they were trying to get it released, like, right around the beginning of the pandemic, which was when there wasn't any production even happening. So the opportunity to fix not being there maybe forced their hand on some of these choices.
Stamets knows the score here. He knows this is new Star Trek, and the chance of him being tortured in an especially gruesome way is on the table. He's like, you're gonna take these tardigrade cells out of me in a very traumatic way.
Yeah.
I know it. You know it. The American people know it. And Aurelio's like, actually, no, man. Like this is the future, remember?
Yeah.
We're gonna take a couple of those cells and we're gonna grow them in a test tube, because that's the way we do things around here. And also, Osira is not that bad.
Yeah. I mean, Stamets is doing very reasonable math, like, assuming Aurelio is motivated by evil, because Aurelio is wearing the costume of an evil man and is friends with Osira. And what he doesn't realize is that Aurelio imagines himself to be a moral man.
Yeah.
But Adam, no ethical consumption in capitalism. And we know from the negotiations between Osira and the Admiral that the Emerald Chain is a capitalist society. And that's going to be one of the tricky things to change if there's a merger.
Why should the Federation have 99% of the old comm badges? Well, the Emerald Chain just gets this one dumpster of the old comm badges. It's unfair.
Dilithium should be a human right, and yet only Koryas are allowed. In the Jeffries tubes, some of the regulators catch up with Michael Burnham, but not before she's come up with a plan to blow them out the airlock like a alien fucking queen, which she does. Very fun scene. We think maybe Michael Burnham goes with because her belt breaks at the last minute. But, you know, like, there's that pregnant pause, and then we hear her come over the radio on the bridge, call Nate Dogg and Warren G, because you're going to need a few more regulators.
Mauna.
Zara's like, what? Oh, man. This is not supposed to be funny, but when they cut to the exterior and then back onto the bridge and they look at the view screen and they see that regulator just holding two boots frozen and like rotating in space, that is such a shitty way to go, holding onto boots. I don't know why that was such a visceral reaction for me, but like that is shameful and embarrassing.
Adam, I yelled at my television, let go of the boots and try and grab something.
Yeah, yeah. That regulator did a great job, is what we learned.
Yeah, she tried. She tried really hard. Invigilator Aurelio explains to Stamets, listen, man, like Osiris is actually a really...
The Invigilator takes D batteries, like three of them. It's like a fucking mag light.
Yeah, yeah. And it only runs for like 15 minutes tops.
Yeah, it really works hard.
But it fucking works. He's like, Osiris is a great person. I shouldn't be alive. I have a genetic defect that, you know, makes me have to use this wheelchair. In your time, that might not have been such a big deal, but in my time, it really is. And Osiris saw the potential in me.
He's like, tell me about the wheelchairs of your time. And Stamets is like, ooh. There's just kind of a lot of beeping involved.
Well, it's an interesting point because, like, you know, the disability community have long called for more representation on Star Trek, and people that use wheelchairs have seen very little of themselves in Star Trek before. And while I am a person that would like more disability representation in media and think representation matters generally, like it always was a bit of a puzzle to me in Star Trek, because in the future, wouldn't you imagine that a problem like that was solvable in a way that was better than in our time, in whatever form that takes? And I think it's great that now that they are in a time where it is less solvable, they're taking the opportunity to kind of write that wrong and not just like a paragon of good character that uses a wheelchair. It's a complicated character that uses a wheelchair.
There are times in the show when I resist and resent a character talking about the contemporary within the context of, you know, what their character's going through or where a story is taking us. But there's a dimensionality to Kenneth Mitchell's performance here when he describes his circumstances as they were as a child and what they are now, that I found totally riveting. Like there's a real person in there talking about his circumstance through a character's voice that is saying something similarly that I just found really affecting. And like, I'm really, really, like Kenneth Mitchell did good and fun work as Klingons before, but like, cool. Like they're Klingons and he's acting Klingon-y, but like to give him a role where like this, like makes me really glad that he's back on the show in a way that without a scene like this, I would have just been like, Kenneth Mitchell did great work. But like now I know Kenneth Mitchell does fucking great work.
He's got game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see the conflict in him and why he feels loyalty to Osira. And it's really brilliant the way Stamets finds a way to undercut that.
Yeah. Back at the negotiating table, the bomb gets dropped. You're eating shit. Osira, how's my shit taste?
Yeah.
Here's how it tastes. It tastes like a fucking browned apple that's been sliced open and left to turn brown in a room.
Yeah. And specifically the kind of apple that you buy like wrapped in cellophane at an airport.
That's a bad apple, whether or not it's made of shit.
Yeah.
I wanted the lie detector and in on this moment so bad, Ben. Like the comedy fruit was hanging so low that when Admiral, you're eating my shit, says you're eating my shit, I wanted the lie detector to be like, that's true.
I know.
So fucking hard.
Yeah.
We're going to have to get used to this as a society, right? If we have dreams of space travel, the recycling of waste into something we consume has just got to be a part of that math, right?
We fertilize crops with shit, so it's not like that far from what we currently do. Yeah. It's just a electromechanical process instead of a biological process in the future.
So things are really coming to a head at the negotiating table. Osira wants the recognition and acceptance of their way of life, the chain way of life.
Right.
She wants an embassy, and in exchange, she's willing to abolish the slavery aspects of their society if it means getting these concessions.
This is what I love about this scene is that like the Admiral is like, hey, listen, like I know that you have like lots of good people living in the Emerald Chain, but you have supervised it all and there is slavery and shit in the Emerald Chain. And he rejects her. And like, I kind of feel like in some ways he was stringing her along until he could get to this point. Like, I love the fact that that is like a total sticking point for him. Like, until you are like personally held accountable for the crimes of capitalism that took place in the Emerald Chain, like, we can't actually do business with you. Like, and also the fact that unchecked capitalism leads to slavery, just being like baked into his assumptions about what dealing with the chain will mean, is really powerful writing, I think.
I like the idea of this being like a post-Civil War reconstruction conversation, but what this negotiation lacks is that past relationship. Like, where is that dimension of we were once all together and we can be again, instead of these are our separate lanes, let's merge lanes finally,
right,
after all this time. There's that part of it is lacking in a way that I feel like could really give it some juice.
Yeah. The problem is we just don't have enough time to talk about like the civil society institutions that exist in the Emerald Chain to hold an Osira to account. And
right,
that's what he's calling for, is like an elected leader to represent them to this new like reformed federation or whatever. And she's like, no fucking way. Like, that's going to be my sock puppet and I'm going to stay 100% in charge of my shit.
Yeah, like Robert E. Greene can't continue to lead the Emerald Chain post-Reconstruction, right?
Right.
And I love this moment. Like we can take as much time as we want batting this around, but even Osira is like, look, here's the armistice document. Like, there's a lot of fine print here. So just go and sit alone with this for a while.
Yeah.
Because we need to go get back to the action movie already in progress.
So she beams back to the ship. She's pissed at Zara. She's on the bridge. She actually asks Invigilator Aurelio, like, maybe you don't want to be on the bridge for this next part. And he's tempted now. He's like, he's got a seed planted in his mind by Stamets. Michael Burnham has already stunned Invigilator Aurelio and taken Stamets, but,
God, we're going to get so much Invigilator art. It's going to be so fucking crazy.
I hope so.
Look, I don't want my wife walking in while I'm looking at Invigilator memes, okay? That's not going to go well for me.
Yeah. Put your browser in private mode before you open the Invigilator threads.
It's kind of weak soup that Stamets counters Aurelio's Osira isn't so bad story with, they used pesticides on Quajon.
Right.
Like, that's a very like cause a riot in Whole Foods counter argument here. Like, I think you need something toothier than that.
Yeah, but he's there for Osira blowing away Rin, and I think that's the thing that undoes, you know, that lets the scales fall from his eyes. And
right.
And this is like on the heels of Book like offering Osira the dilithium as big as the Ritz.
That always happens though. The like, fine, I'll give you what you want. And then there's that pregnant pause, and then Rin is turned into Windex on the bridge.
Yeah.
Pretty messed up. I mean, that's up. That cutback to Aurelio is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that leads us to the season finale. Like, he's going to be instrumental in the takedown.
Right. Just a couple more scenes. Stamets, of course, on being freed, was basically getting ready to spork jump to to the simulation where his husband and adoptive teen genius Charge are. And Michael Burnham stopped him, like, in a very, like, Burnham on Burnham kind of way. Like, he was acting very Burnham-y in, like, a fuck everything else that's going on. This is the most important thing to me, and therefore we're doing it.
That is a super elegant way to describe this. Yeah.
But he does not have the same luxury that she does. She stuns him, and she puts him in like a seed pod that she's going to blow out the side of the ship and let the Federation take him. And this last moment of his is very, like, tearful and desperate. He really believes that she is dooming his family to death. And boy, I wonder if their relationship can recover from that.
I think Anthony Rapp got two runs at this. He gets that scene pre-neck pinch where he says, "My whole life is in that nebula."
Yeah.
Anthony Rapp is great in that scene, but I don't believe that is a good moment. Like, I think you're fortunate to have an actor who could pull this off the way he does.
Yeah.
I think we describe this sometimes in Deep Space Nine, how you get a couple of really talented actors in a room going back and forth, and you can see them, like, really playing the actor tennis. And it, like, making each other great in the process. These are two really great actors in the same room trying to turn this dialogue into something meaningful, trying to turn their personal stories into something with a huge amount of gravity that isn't totally earned. Like, Anthony Rapp carries this moment, but I think the second moment is far better. Like, the moment where he's in the egg and he's about to be blown out is, like, I almost wish you could remove the first one in favor of the second one.
Hmm.
Because I think in the context of the story and in their characters and in their relationship to each other, I thought the second one, like, it really hit me. I thought it was a great moment for him as an actor and Stamets as a character. And I love how, like, it's an indictment of Michael Burnham's choices as they compare to the rest of the crew's sacrifices. That needs to be said, and he's right to say it.
Yeah.
Like, who are you to suddenly, like, it's always about Michael Burnham.
Right.
It's always about what she wants. What about asshole Stamets, ready to be an asshole again?
I was really glad that they avoided any needs of the many type phrasing in this conversation, because it's there in the subtext, but if it had been said, I feel like it would have cheapened the moment and just been like, hey, a Star Trek thing. And instead, it felt really authentic and good.
I wish that Stamets fought back harder physically in that moment before he was neck pinched. You know, like, it's so...
It's a very primal moment, and you could see him doing it.
Yeah. Like, I almost wanted, like, for his own safety, it to be kind of a mercy neck pinch,
right,
versus a Michael Burnham's trying to accomplish a mission neck pinch, which feels very different.
Right.
In this context. And I think would have juiced the Stamets a little bit more and his motivations there.
What if she neck pinched him and then put her hand on his face and said, "Remember," and then gotten in the spork box herself?
I like it. Really like it.
The button on the episode, Adam, is the bridge crew, now free and roaming about the ship, arm themselves in the armory and hear something coming. What's it going to be, Adam? They got to get ready. They got to get in cool fighting tableau, dual wielding pistols and stuff, but it's no threat. It's some cute little robos who are the Sphere Data. The Sphere Data has collected itself in these robos and is now riding to their rescue. Robots are the cavalry.
What kind of raid configuration are we talking about here? If you destroy one robo, have you corrupted all of your Sphere Data?
I don't know.
Or are they hot swappable?
Yeah. Is it one is none, two is one, three is enough kind of a situation. Like, if one of these robots gets blown away, what happens?
I was appalled that they all flashed the shocker as some kind of salute. Like, what the hell?
What is this, the late 90s? Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all big Dane Cook fans, these Dot 23s. And that really, like, a very abrupt end of episode here.
It's a smash to black. Did you like the episode, Adam?
It was a fun genre bash of Die Hard and Star Trek in the way that you described, but I just wish...
And Mr. Deeds.
And Mr. Deeds, right. It is all three. It is, I mean, it is the holy trinity of genre
really
blending,
is.
If you will. The Three Temples theory lives on in another show. I wish I could figure out the attitude of future Starfleet a little better, because, like, I want to believe more that this is a way of being that is worth saving. Like, is it worth living in this future?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's such a lack of joy in anything having to do with Starfleet right now, that when you see Michael Burnham make her sacrifices, when she forces the other people around her to make those sacrifices to preserve this way of life, I just kind of wish I cared more about such preservation.
Yeah.
And I think there was an opportunity to make a stronger case for that throughout the season, that makes these sacrifices feel hollow and character based versus story and setting based like they might be otherwise.
I really agree with that. I feel like in that moment when she is like packing Stamets up in the escape pod and says that, like I know that those three people are really important to both of us, but this is about everybody in the Federation. Like, it hit me in that moment, like, if we had had this moment in season four, after we've spent some fucking time in the Federation as it currently exists and seen anything about it, it would have hit so much harder. But it's all implied so far. So while that is true, I thought this episode was super fun. I'm here for the mashup, and I liked the twists and turns. There were some great moments of surprise and some really fun performances in this episode. So on balance, an episode I liked quite a bit.
Well, we're going to have to see if we get some priority one messages we like quite a bit as we check our priority one message inbox, which is it's a system that we always back up in triplicate to make sure we don't lose any.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Adam, we have one priority one message here. It is of a promotional nature. And it goes like this. You find yourself looking for new comedic podcasts from a source you can trust. Are you a fan of the Bravo show Vanderpump Rules? Yes. Does the idea of reality TV get you grumpy? Yes. If you answered yes to one of these questions, then Vanderpump Robs is the podcast for you. Join Greatest Discovery producer Rob Schulte as he attempts to watch every episode of VPR. Season 2 begins January 7th. Special guests include James Arthur, Allison Rosen, Dan Kennedy, Leah Palmieri, and some guy named Ben. I promise you'll love it.
I mean, that's a hell of a promise there, Rob.
Yeah, that's a...
as someone who's not seen a minute of Vanderpump Rules, I mean, I just don't know. I trust you. I trust your judgment.
I bet you don't even have to watch the show to enjoy Vanderpump Rob's.
I enjoy Rob's quite a bit, so that works.
The call to action is subscribe to Vanderpump Rob's, a sexy, unique recap podcast. Do you know what sexy, unique recap refers to?
No.
Lisa Vanderpump owns a restaurant called Sir, and that is short for Sexy Unique Restaurant.
Oh my God.
That's where most of Vanderpump Rules takes place.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally, like, almost unimaginably self-parodic and yet sincere.
Rob's knows his stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. I can't recommend this highly enough. I've been a guest on the show. I talked to Dan Kennedy, who was also a guest on the show, and after watching one episode to recap with Rob's on Vanderpump Rob's, Dan Kennedy became a total Vanderpump stan.
No way.
So do with that information what you will, but check out Vanderpump Rob's on your podcatcher of choice.
Wow. Yeah, and thanks to Rob's for spending his own money on a Priority One message. Yeah. Priority One messages, of course, support the ongoing production of The Greatest Discovery, as well as the rest of the Uxbridge Shimoda family of podcasts, all of them sexy and unique.
Indeed.
We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that. Being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second, go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
I think I'm just going to give it to Rin for being a real fun character arc. I love the like last stand, like I'm here with you book. We're going to kill a bunch of motorcycle bad guys before they take us alive moment with Rin. A bit ridiculous that they would kill that many dudes and then be taken without a scratch on their heads.
Right. It's a very Star Wars analogy to have a bunch of stormtroopers burst forth, yeah, and then be easily picked off that way.
But also, like, Rin's one piece of leverage is that he knows the big secret about the chain. And the second Osira finds out that the Admiral knows about the about that secret, she has no reason to keep him alive. And I knew in that moment that his number was up, and I was pretty sad about it because I liked that character a lot.
Yeah, I was sad to see him go too. I think it's too bad characters that have a chance to become interesting are killed so quickly. I think his had a chance to be one of those.
Yeah, but as was proved by Invigilator Aurelio, if you've got loaf the first time you come out on the show, You could come back as something else.
I'll never not laugh at Invigilator. Zara is my Edward Larkin. I mean, kind of a no-win situation for him, I guess. I mean, he is making all the bad choices. He is the guy with the stinky hand. he's going to take the fall for this, which sucks. He's allowed all of this bad stuff to happen. And I think that's a very Edward Larkin way to be on an episode specifically, like to make as many mistakes as he does.
Yeah.
This ep is very Larkin-esque.
Indeed.
Well, we got a season finale coming up next week, Ben. I can't believe it. We're going to make it to the end of our 23-week in a row run.
It's true. I watched the promo. It looked like a lot more of same, a lot more kind of action movie stuff, which, you know, I like action movies. I don't want my Trek to be all action all the time, but I'm curious about that. And interestingly, it looks like next week is action movie blended with stuff back on the ship,
right,
in the simulation with the survivor.
Right. We still have that situation happening over there.
Yeah.
Just a regular sized episode. Yeah. You think that's just an hour or something? Or are they going to give us longer?
I don't know. That'd be interesting to see. Well, thanks for checking out The Greatest Discovery this week. I think it's time to leave it with Rob's.
Thanks for doing the show this week, Ben. There was a moment where, who knows? Not it happened.
Yeah, we made it happen.
Glad you're feeling better, man. Love you lots.
Thanks, bud.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison. The show is produced by me, Rob Schulte. Please check out Vanderpump Rob's wherever you get your podcasts. It's a lot of fun, with edits made by Friend of DeSoto Marie Hill and original music composed by Friend of DeSoto Jeremy Siegel. I promise you don't have to watch the show to enjoy the pod. The Greatest Discovery's theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Check out his YouTube page to find your next recipe. And if you're looking for more Trek, why don't you discover some of our off-season episodes? The Mirror Universe comic books are some of my favorites. Don't forget, you can now follow us on Instagram and Twitter under the handles Greatest Trek. Those accounts are run by the great Bill Tilly. We really appreciate you, Bill. You're doing great work over there. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week on The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.